This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Cambridge Muslim College, training the next generation of Muslim thinkers.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. Welcome to Cambridge Muslim College's second annual retreat. And my name is Davina and I'm the Development Officer at CMC. We're delighted to have you here, especially those who have come all the way just for this talk. A special warm welcome to those who have joined us on Facebook Live. This is CMC's very first Facebook Live session. We'd like to encourage you to please share the link with your friends, make comments throughout the talk, and we will also be taking questions from Facebook at the Q&A, especially, and also from the audience. Now, just for the benefit of those who may not have heard about Cambridge Muslim College before this night, Cambridge Muslim College's vision is to improve the quality of Muslim leadership in the UK and beyond. Since its establishment, we've had a diploma in contextual Islamic studies, which aims to train men and women with a background in Islamic studies to more effectively implement their knowledge in today's world. Recently, we've also launched a four-year program in Islamic studies. Inshallah, we hope that this will become a BA degree, subject to an award from a validation from an external body. Applications are now open for both programs, so we encourage you to please go on our website, cambridgemuslimcollege.org, for more information. We're also in the process of developing more external programs, courses both at CMC as well as online for our wider audience. So please sign up to the mailing list through the website to stay updated, as well as through social media. Tonight's talk is medical benefits from the Sunnah. In recent years, you may have read online on articles about research, say for instance, on the benefits of intermittent fasting on physical health. So is there an intrinsic link between acts of worship, ibadah such as prayer, salah, fasting, psalm, and physical health? And has there been recent medical research that substantiates and sheds light on these links? So without further delay, I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murat. He's the founder and dean of Cambridge Muslim College. He was educated at Cambridge, Al-Azhar, and London universities, and is currently the Sheikh Zayed Lecturer of Islamic Studies in the Faculty of Divinity at Cambridge University. He has published and contributed to numerous academic works on Islam, including as director of the Sunnah Project, and is a leading figure in interfaith activity, notably as one of the signatories to the Common Word Statement. He is well known as a contributor to BBC Radio 4's Thought for the Day. Sheikh Abdul Hakim.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. As friends of Cambridge Muslim College, most of you will already be aware that one of our preoccupations is to maintain a research focus on the interface between science and religion. Our diploma and also our new four-year program, which Sister Davina's just mentioned, incorporate very significant teaching modules on science and how this impacts on Muslim doctrinal and legal thinking. We're also the host institution for the Center of Islam and Medicine. And we also host, thanks to a generous donation from the Templeton Foundation, two full-time research fellows who specialize precisely in Islam and science. And these are Dr. Asim Islam, who works on number set theory and cosmology. You heard his fascinating lecture earlier today. And we also have Professor John Mabry, who's a consultant gastroenterologist, who's working on the medical outcomes of the regular habit of Muslim prayer for, as well as by, sick persons. Both are organizing what look like very promising conferences at CMC later this year. Dr. Asim's has already been announced under the title of What is Consciousness and Why Observers Matter in Quantum Theory? So CMC's determination really to be the world's leading hub for research into the science-Islam interaction relates to our conviction that the modern world presents significant challenges to Muslim thought and practice which need to be very accurately rather than emotively understood and resolved. However, the science-Islam relation cannot be treated as the occasion for the collocation of individual firefighting exercises, as so often happens, dealing with the challenges one by one: Islam and natural selection, Islam and artificial intelligence, Islam and organ transplantation, and so on. Very often our approach tends to be quite bitty and atomized. Common really to all these theological, ethical, and fiqh puzzles is the much deeper theological issue of how Islam views matter and its processes and the nature of the divine agency in the world. So it's one of our longer-term ambitions to focus on the questions of cosmology and causation, being, as it were, the underlying sort of scientific issue on the basis of which the others rest, drawing from the insights particularly of our Kalam heritage in challenging some very popular understandings or perhaps misunderstandings of their religion-science relation, which are often, in the Western context, based on Christianity's very different view of matter and divine power. And what we're looking for is something distinctively Islamic. So today, this evening, I want to offer a few thoughts on how our own Muslim theological understanding of nature might pertain not so much to these deeper questions of being and omnipotence, those really big questions, but rather, as it were, to the second Shahada. If our theologians agree that the world of manifestation which we inhabit, the created world, the kaun of time and space, is not split into sacred and profane under the erratic guidance of a god who runs some aspect of the cosmic totality but not others, in other words, if we resolutely and completely reject any kind of dualism and say that he is ala kulli shay'in qadir, powerful over all things, then the second Shahada has to loyally follow the totalizing and uncompromising metaphysics of the first. Where many Christians, for instance, see Jesus entering and redeeming a natural world which has been made dark and broken by Adam's sin, Muslims have always developed a vision of the final prophet who reminds mankind of the world's complete surrender to God in a way which emphasizes man's full belongingness to it. Hence, unlike the Christ of the Gospels, our founder is part of his people's economic, political, and marital life. His example, the Sunnah, is all-embracing. Now, the centrality and the importance of following the Sunnah, it hardly needs sort of repeating or emphasizing to a Muslim audience, because Allah has said, لَقَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنَةٌ. There has ever been for you in Allah's messenger an excellent exemplar. The hasana here recalls the usual Arabic combination of husn, the good and the beautiful. So he is a worker of what is right, but also of what is beautiful. So in copying him, in his emulation, there is the restoration in the human order of beauty to the world. This is the meaning, really, of the hadith that says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ كَتَبَ الْإِحْسَانَ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ. God has prescribed ihsan, doing the beautiful in all things. And the hadith then goes on to enjoin us to do certain specific things beautifully. وَإِذَا ذَبَحَ أَحَدُكُمْ فَلْيُحْسِنِ الذِّبْحَ. For instance, when one of you slaughters an animal, let him do so well and beautifully. The commentators, wondering why that particular example is given in the hadith, tell us that the Holy Prophet uses this example, apparently an earthly one, rhetorically, to show that beauty can appear in even the most mundane and even apparently disagreeable necessities. If one can slit a sheep's throat in a way which in some way evinces beauty, doing it well, how much more easy is it beautifully to design a building, or illuminate a manuscript, or recite the Quran with a mellifluous voice? In our revelation, the world is portrayed for us as something surpassingly beautiful, and to take our due place within it, we are to act with a beauty that has to be commensurate. Considering the beauty of the stars and the seas, that is not a very easy commandment for us poor beings of mud to obey. But man, although he's proved a tyrant and a fool, has taken this trust, this amana, upon himself. He is to be custodian of the same natural world of which he is fully a part. So our perfect man, our insan kamil, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, thus balances in his soul the balance, mizan, which we see in nature. And just as nature contains the jalal, as well as the jamal, the divine qualities of rigor, as well as of beauty, His own nature necessarily manifests that combination as well in due and spectacular balance. Just as nature contains aspects of rigor reflecting that aspect of the divine fullness, so too does the heart of the Holy Prophet. His sunnah, in other words, inwardly mirrors the sunnah of God himself in the world. And hence a human being who lives the sunnah inwardly and outwardly, uniting and balancing these qualities, these complementary properties of rigor and beauty, justice and mercy, inevitably recalls the closeness of the divine. He or also she is a holy person. Now, we all know that the Quran is a book which we are invited to read, but it also invites us to read the other book, the book of nature. Our religion calls itself the Deen al-Fitra, the religion of primordial human nature, primordial natural state. The term Hanifiyya, which is important in our Abrahamic understanding of our ancient primordial roots, the term Hanifiyya recalls this also. As the revelation, which purports to be for the end of time, the Qur'an also recalls the sacred style of, as it were, the beginning of time, truly ancient times. Hence its remarkable focus on nature and on the human need to read nature and to understand what it tells us about nature's author. So recall this verse, for instance. وَأَقِمْ وَجْهَكَ لِلدِّينِ حَنِيفًا. Stay your face towards the religion as a hanif, God's nature, fitra, upon which he created humanity. There is no change in God's creation. That is the upright religion. So the sense is that by being Abrahamic, we move to a time before Judaism and Christianity, and really before civilization as we know it, back to a time of nature. And the commentator Tabari adds that this verse refers to our humanity back to the time of Adam himself. Truly ours is presented as the religion which recalls the normality of ancient times, which nowadays paleontologists, archaeologists would say represents 99% of the history of our species. So the Holy Prophet points to nature as he himself reminds us of God. Human time began with a garden and ends, for the blessed, with a garden. Luxuriant, exquisite nature is thus, in this deep sense, our natural abode. It is where we are most profoundly at home. In its presence, the heart finds itself opening up. And there's an evident symbolism in his domicile in the oasis of Medina, far from the sophisticated urban forms of classical antiquity, but surrounded by verdure, indicated perhaps symbolically by the very greenness of his dome. Now, here one could say so much about the Holy Prophet's engagement with nature, specifically his respect for the trees and the mountains, his defense of animals, even in the hadith, his apparent ability to communicate with them. But given that our subject this evening is about the medical aspects of the sunnah, that aspect of his perfection is relevant in a generic way, insofar as we intuit that we feel better when in the presence of nature or with animals or when we just look up at the sky. Something within us is uplifted. Few human souls ever can have failed to notice that upliftment and inner joy. And that joy and sense of return, of rightness and of peace is certainly health-giving. To see beauty, and particularly the beauty of virgin nature, nourishes the soul with spiritual and also measurable physiological consequences. So that's the kind of first point that I want to look at, the prophetic and the Quranic direction that we should look to nature as the first of the medical benefits of the sunnah. Some of this has been picked up in the work of somebody called Semir Zeki, who is a professor of neuroaesthetics at UCL. Most of his recent research has focused on demonstrating the brain's identification of and response to beauty, both visual and musical beauty. It turns out to be a gigantically subtle process, but the conclusion, for our purposes, seems to be clear. beauty is not perceived primarily as the result of cultural conditioning. It's not just cultures that decide what's beautiful and what's beautiful, not beautiful, but it's something that we are somehow designed to perceive. It's within us. And hence, when we perceive ugliness instead, human consciousness naturally, instinctively recoils and reacts negatively. To pick up on a point that I was making in my lecture yesterday, scientists have been trying to discern what types of music correspond to which human behavioural types. The biggest project, I think, at the moment is one that has been undertaken at Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh, which seems to indicate that those who listen to the blues apparently are creative and at ease with themselves, whereas rock and heavy metal fans have low self-esteem and are generally not outgoing people. You can look it up, and that's the outcome of their research. But let's set that aside and return to the one who we are proposing to describe as the prophet of nature, the end-time messenger who in this very timely and urgent way reminds us that we are part of the natural world, despite our generation's often quite deliberate attack on nature, the ecosystem, and also natural human manners of behaving. We could say that we find in him four dimensions, which are in very many traditional societies and literatures seen as the four dimensions of human perfection, in a specifically masculine mode. So William Blake, for instance, writes this: "Four mighty ones are in every man. A perfect unity cannot exist but from the universal brotherhood of Eden, the universal man to whom be glory evermore." And Blake has a very long and often quite indigestible poem called The Vala, in which he is essentially talking about these four manly qualities, which he feared already in his time, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, were being eroded by a scientific and materialistic worldview. So these are the four aspects of the perfect human being: mind, heart, loins, and the principle of the balance between them. It sounds a little bit like Plato, but it's actually a different set of principles. Now, in our time, with its confusions and anxieties about gender, one of the classic books of the so-called men's movement has been a book by Robert Moore and Douglas Gillette, which is called King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, Rediscovering the Archetypes of the Mature Masculine. It's a bestseller amongst Americans who are anxious about, and it's also in this country, I think, anxious about what manhood can mean in a feminist world, a world of equality, a world in which increasingly people choose and redefine their gender identities. What are we losing? And the authors actually spend some time on Blake and his understanding of this vala, this four virtues, this four archetypes. And they're writing really not as theologians, but as psychotherapists and as counselors, dealing with the current crisis of manhood as they see it. So they ask, why is so much male behavior nowadays dysfunctional? So many men in gangs, prison, failing to lead families or to support their wives and children. And they believe that it's because of our detachment from nature, from our ancient and primordial selfhood. And in particular, we lack the capacity to reconnect with those ancient human archetypes. Now, Blake had rejected Orthodox Christianity, really. Remember the dark satanic Mills in his famous song? He's actually talking about the church. He's not talking about the factories. He never went to church. Instead, he believed in a kind of Platonism, in human perfectibility through the rediscovery of ancient intrinsic archetypes discovered through primordial virtues. And this Platonism allowed him to reject the Christian idea of original sin, the intrinsic brokenness of our fallen human nature. For Blake, as in Islam, nature is fully indicative. That's very Platonic. And the body and its tendency towards life, its natural teleology towards living, towards flourishing, is to be affirmed and not fought. Yet nowadays, as these authors, Moore and Gillette, affirm, we are a long way from that. Nowadays, for example, boys are no longer initiated into manhood, and they may often lack male mentors, particularly in a school environment where teachers very often are mainly female, and all the teachers are really busy with paperwork. And the result, they say, can be immature behavior or tyranny. In other words, transplanted into our language, we say we have deprived them of bay'ah and of nasiha and of any kind of socially recognized transition from boyhood into manhood, where mind, heart, eros, and completeness, these four things in valor, mind, heart, eros, completeness, are held in disciplined balance. We just don't have a generation that can initiate the young male into that any longer, and hence the dysfunction. And this is one cause, they say, of the frequently heard female complaint, there are no men anymore. Men, including, we should say, many Muslim men, seem to be nowadays rather disconsolate, weedy, introverted, unwilling to lead, to love, and to show the traditional virile virtues. And we often hear that women are, in this context, somewhat less damaged. It's true that there is a steady increase in rates of female depression, suicide, self-harm, dieting disorders, and so forth. So one in four American women has struggled with mental health issues. One in four British women now has actually self-harmed at some point. And the rate of post-traumatic stress disorder amongst women has apparently trebled in 10 years. So we're dealing with a very quick acceleration of the process of some kind of deep spiritual systemic trauma. Still, women are not filling the prisons, and only a minority of fundamentalists are women. The extreme aberrations tend to be male aberrations. And the reason seems to be clear enough. In former times, men, including Muslim men, were initiated into their manhood through bay'ah, or through joining the guilds, the asnaf, or a tariqah. While now these ancient processes, these rites of passage, disciplined tawbah, hardly exist, unless, of course, there's some ritual for joining a gang, which is a kind of perverse indication of something that should be there that society is not supplying. Women, however, initiated spontaneously by the onset of the menstrual cycle. They know intuitively that they have matured, become women, for something extraordinary and marvelous. So it's harder in general for women to become detached from the body and hence from nature, and hence from remembering God. So in our time, the most crude and outspoken, loudmouth atheists tend to be men, while the most solid custodians of traditional religion are very often women. Now, a lot could be said about the way in which Islam, which deliberately and explicitly in its founding moment and in the Quran, enshrines a natural form of life for women, promotes well-being. Those who have entered Islam from a past of confusion about gender and Prozac taking, broken relationships, often seem to embrace it with a kind of palpable relief and recognition. Maybe one reason for the often, to some, mystifying fact that the majority of educated converts to Islam in Britain are women. Puzzles secular and feminist commentators, but there may be some clue to this here. Of course, some of Islam's social structures of wisdom are offensive to our anti-natural and atheistical age, but that is probably not something that should worry us, but perhaps should reassure us. Religions which comply with the value set of our profane time are unlikely to be religions at all. They're just strategies of accommodation, secularization. Still, I'm not going to be talking today about Islam's gift for reconnecting us to a natural way of being through gender specifically, partly because the topic of gender has been done and done to death so many times. Too many others are talking about that. Instead, let's rewind a bit and consider the implications of the way in which we're talking about the Holy Prophet as the man of the Deen al-Fitra. What does this tell us specifically about his way? We know that Islam is not just a package of beliefs, but is enactment, action, engagement, relationality, mu'amala, engagement with God, with mankind, with the natural world. And in the deep forms of its five pillars, we are going to find an abundance of clues. The first shahada does not comprise faith, but it points to faith, which is the essence and purpose of
everything. It's the most evident of these natural forms towards which the fitrah is pointing. La ilaha illallah evidently means not only that so-called gods apart from the one God are merely human figments with no reality, but that every source of power and apparent causality in the world is entirely subject to the divine command. Kullu lahu qanitun. Everything is aslama, Muslim, totality. God is not a kind of, as they say, deus absconditus, a God who somehow doesn't seem to be around, who's receded from a cosmos that is therefore dark and without divine control. The fullness of Islamic monotheism always recognizes that omnipotence, this ala kulli shay'in qadir, means what it purports to mean. He knows every leaf that falls. He threw, and the Holy Prophet threw. He created us. He created what we do. Ala kulli shay'in qadir. And this was the victory of Sunnism over the Mu'tazila particularly. So no dualism, therefore. God is not descending in a halo of light into a world that has gone wrong, that's out of his control, trying to put it right with looking around only indifferent success. The Qur'an refutes all crypto-pagan suggestions of a partially active but still effectively resisted deity. Instead, the marvels and the sublimity and the order of the created world, the natural world to which it directs our attention, are entirely his handiwork. There's no co-author. Even time itself, as the quantum theorists and the Asharites often seem to agree, is not what we think it is. His qurb, his closeness, his presence is total and incessant. And this is the basis of our view of nature. Now, Islam is certainly not animism, but if animism is, in a sense, the rejection of the distinction between the natural and the supernatural, might be a definition, then Ash'ari theology in particular, with its insistence that every atom moves by the direct divine power, might be said to push back, to roll back Cartesian, Aristotelian, and often Christian ideas of a dualism between nature and spirit and return us to a very antique modality of experiencing the stuff of the world. His qurb, his closeness, and his omnipotence ensure, as it were, maximal sacrality to the natural order. And this is normal, fitri, human believing. So the atheist sees the world as undirected or as existing in the grip of a merciless, relentless set of physical laws. It has no purpose and there are no reassurances. But this terrifying and inhuman vision is not normal. Since the Upper Paleolithic, human beings have been religious. Some academics are now even wondering whether religiosity is so natural to ourselves that atheism should technically be considered a mental illness. It's so intrinsic to what we've always been. It's part of our normal metabolism. Now, however that might be, the advantages of belief in the unseen are evident. The believer's soul is protected by the armor of confidence and trust in God's providence. His sense of guilt is assuaged by his knowledge of God's mercy and forgiveness. His pain and suffering are made easier to bear by his awareness that on some level, probably incalculable to his finite mind, there is wisdom in all things. Hence, religiosity itself is healthy, helping us to deal with stress, releasing endorphins into our system. It's the normal human attitude to which the metabolism and the brain have been adapted for hundreds of thousands of years. Nobody knows exactly how long, but maybe something of that order. So we are homo religiosus. It's the nature of our species, and it's a fact which the medical curricula are now increasingly taking note of. Religious faith and its associated emotions, particularly gratitude, are known to boost serotonin production. Actively religious people live noticeably longer than agnostics and atheists, or those who believe in a religion but don't practice it. So a very famous study at the University of Colorado, which worked on 28,000 people, found that regular worshippers live on average 7 years longer than others. And this is not apparently the obvious case of people who are in any case living a more healthy life, avoiding alcohol and other narcotics, for instance, not smoking, because the researchers took care to factor in education level, tobacco, alcohol use, just to ensure parity in the findings. For some causes of morbidity, the correlation was even more striking. They found that death from respiratory disease, for instance, was around twice as likely for people who did not believe or worship in a congregation. Generally, it seems to be the subtler diseases, asthma, allergies, and so forth, which have a strong psychological component, which are likely to impact significantly less on those who have strong religious commitments. And that finding, that was the first big one, but it's been correlated by literally hundreds of other studies, and it's now generally accepted that religiosity, as a general principle, is strongly associated with better health outcomes and longevity prospects. There's a more subtle dimension to this insofar as our lifespans are as long as we experience them to be. And here also it is emerging that religion stretches our lives in remarkable ways. The experience of the sublime, of Heber, has been shown to enhance our sense of being present in the moment and also our subjective experience of time. The more magnificent and awe-inspiring we find the world to be, the longer our lives seem to be for us. So Stanford University professor Stephanie Rudd, who's looked into this phenomenon, says, quote, "When you feel awe, you feel very present. It captivates you in the current moment. And when you are so focused on the here and now, the present moment is expanded and time along with it." And that really corresponds very precisely with the Quranic injunction to utter the Subhanallah when we consider creation and each other and life itself, all the more wonderful and amazing when we realize that it's not a dull, meaningless concatenation of particles, but is the divine artistry. It's the nature of the believer and the gift of faith to see the world as intrinsically astounding. So already we find that following a religion, and hence to be in harmony, what human beings have been adapted to for tens of thousands of years, has massively benign health impacts. But earlier I was speaking specifically of Islam as being the Deen al-Fitra. So narrowing the compass a little bit, not talking about religiosity and worship generally, but the specifically Islamic form of this, specifically Muslim practices. Well, we note that the specifically Muhammadan way of relating to the fullness of La ilaha illallah is founded in the four ritual pillars of the Deen, which all enact truly ancient and timeless sacred ways of being human. And the beginning of it is with water. All living things come from water. وَمِنَ الْمَاءِ جَعَلْنَا كُلَّ شَيْءٍ حَيٍّ. And thus it is with our basic practices. We connect with the principle of movement, cyclicality, purity, life itself by engaging personally and intimately with water. In istinja, in wudu, in ghusl, and so on. And the symbolism here mirrors our archetypal human intuition. Water is from heaven, and by connection with heaven, we wipe away our sins and our evil inclinations. The Quran tells us that Allah loves the penitent and loves those who purify themselves. Inna Allaha yuhibbu at-tawwabin wa yuhibbu al-mutatahirin. So ritual purity, which we tend to think is just something to get us a bit less smelly when we go into the masjid, is actually something very profound that has a deep impact on subconscious aspects of the human consciousness. Very important. A hadith even surprises us by saying, At-tahuru shatrul iman. Purity or purification is half of faith, which is a pretty emphatic statement. Half of faith. And Imam Muslim puts this hadith in the book of Wudu, which shows that for the hadith scholars, this is referring to the formal ritual splashing. It's not talking about some abstract intellectual purity or moral purity, it's talking about ablution. Half of faith, well, of course, you can see that it's good basic personal hygiene to wash regularly and to wash your feet. Doctors are going to nod approvingly. But the important thing here, more than that, deeper than that, is the profound psychology that is going on. Not only is it appropriate that we be clean and fragrant when we enter a place of worship or bow to our Maker, but also we intuit that the act of washing somehow influences the soul, because, as we've said, body and soul are not really separate things, but are two facets of one human thing. And what we do to one is going to have an immediate and probably profound impact on the other. Now, psychologists, whether or not they're interested in religion, are perfectly aware of important aspects of what's going on here. Some call it the Macbeth effect. You remember the dramatic scene in Shakespeare where Lady Macbeth frantically tries to wipe out the blood of King Duncan, who is the king who's been murdered. And scientific research confirms the immense impact of ritual washing practices. It's not a trivial thing. It needs to be addressed with hodor and with respect. Experiments show that those who wash are more likely to act ethically or in a selfless way, while those who do not are more willing to engage in profane or egotistic practices. So, for instance, one big study of the so-called Macbeth effect, which was done by Katie Lilienquist and Chen Bozhong of Northwestern and Toronto universities, reported in the journal Science. Their concerns, again, are not specifically on religious rituals. But they find, for instance, that volunteers who are asked to think of an immoral act are then more likely to read the letters W-H as wash and S-P as soap than those who've been asked to think of something morally uplifting. It's a big statistical correlation there. And then they go on to conduct another remarkable experiment. They ask volunteers to imagine in their minds an immoral act and then gave some of them the opportunity to wash their hands, but not others. They then asked them whether they would volunteer to help a needy student. 74% of those who hadn't washed their hands agreed, while only 41% of the others did so. And the reason was those who had not had a chance to wash their hands were trying hard to cleanse themselves by doing something moral. These are big statistical differences just from washing. In other words, all the evidence suggests that the act of washing has a powerful effect, as we would see it, on the soul. We do need those wudu taps before entering Allah's sanctuary in order to prepare ourselves. And perhaps in these scientific findings, we can find further encouragement to follow the prophetic advice to keep our wudu whenever we can, and to renew it whenever we can. It's sound advice for mind and body alike. Renewing the wudu is always going to have this positive impact on us. Related to this, one should mention a hygienic practice which the hadith specifically identifies as one of the customs of the fitrah, which is circumcision. And this Abrahamic practice, no doubt, assists with the mental health concomitant upon cleanliness. But it's more than that. It does seem to confer a number of physical health advantages which are now starting to be understood. So if you look at the World Health Organization website, you'll find that they officially urge countries to adopt mass circumcision programs, specifically because their trials in Africa show that circumcised men are 60% less likely to be infected by HIV than others. 60%. It's estimated that universal circumcision in Africa could save 3 million lives over the next 20 years. That's only one of many factors, incidentally, which give Islam a demographic advantage in Africa. The 10 most heavily infected countries in Africa are all Christian, and the 10 least infected countries in Africa are all Muslim. So the map, if you look at the website, the dividing line between high and low rates of HIV in the continent is essentially the boundary between the two religions, follows it very accurately. Of course, circumcision is only one factor here. There's other things at stake: Muslim modesty rules, reluctance to have free mixing, the prohibition of alcohol, which reduces inhibitions. These are also thought by people who are looking at this to be to make Islam actually the most effective weapon against HIV infection the world has yet developed. Incidentally, I know somebody who used to run a development-oriented radio program in Botswana, where HIV rates are kind of catastrophic. And part of the purpose of this, which was funded by the United States AIDS Agency, was to increase AIDS awareness. And he found that actually the Muslim community was so little affected by HIV in Botswana that he formally suggested to the State Department that he be allowed to use his radio station simply for the promotion of Islam. And they thought about this for a while and then they said, no. It wasn't quite, you know, HIV is bad, but some things are worse, it seems. Anyway, lower rates of STD transmission may account for the still actually not very well understood correlation between circumcision and significantly lower levels of prostate cancer in men. The big British urology journal, BJU International, recently confirmed the general perception that Jewish and Muslim men have lower rates of prostate cancer than the general population. And one theory for this, they're not really sure why it should be, is that STDs may be a factor in the onset of prostate cancer. In any case, having cleansed ourselves outwardly and inwardly, we then embark on the deepest and most ancient act in all human culture, which is worship. This is what we're for. That's the reason for our creation. And down the ages, despite the endless differences between religions, holy ritual has been the central affirming act of human life, the keystone of the individual sense of meaning and of the community's internal cohesion and sense of common purpose. Life without ritual is historically freakish. It is an aberration, like a body trying to continue to live when its heart has been ripped out. Rituals are native and normal to our biology. The repetition of physical motions and of phrases combined with some form of mental self-regulation and direction is a truly archaic practice. EEG and magnetic resonance imaging shows clearly how beneficial rituals are to us. There's even evidence of permanent changes to the brain, thanks to neuroplasticity, quite similar to some changes which are brought about, for instance, by memorization, which we might also talk about. Studies of practitioners of meditation, for instance, regularly show that long-term meditators have larger than normal regions of the prefrontal cortex. The brain actually changes if you're engaged in regular ritual. The implications of this are still not clear, but it's likely that there's numerous benefits to this, including an improved capacity to concentrate and also to remember. And there's another intriguing dimension to this, the normality of ritual. The life of ancient man was shaped by the motions of the sun and the moon. And Islam, as the Deen al-Fitra, recalls us to this ancient aspect of the normality of our species. As Muslims, we use a lunar, not a solar calendar. And so we refuse, as it were, to fight the geometry of the solar system. We are part of it. Sun and moon are bihosban, by measure, and they're there for our reckoning. The Muslim life, which I guess exists for the sake of prayer, is shaped by the rolling of the planet beneath our feet, and also by the moon's stately and beautiful procession through its phases. When we look up and see sun and moon, yesterday we saw the beautiful moon of Rajab here, we saw what our most distant ancestors saw with no change at all. Nothing else in our life is quite so archaic and so fixed and certain. Now, modern neo-pagans, with their attempt to revive their dim and pretty inaccurate speculative memories of how religion was like in pre-Christian England, also try to respect the movements of the sun and the moon. Like ourselves, the pagans seek to understand themselves as being healed through a kind of oneness with nature. But for them, there's no real continuity with that ancient past. For the most part, they're hobbyists, play-acting, middle-class hobbyists engaged in amateur theatricals, really. It's not real paganism. Now, we play a more serious game. We are authentic. We are in living, unbroken continuity with a primordial past. Nobody is really going to revive belief in Odin or Hecate. The neo-pagans don't really have authentic access to ancient tradition. Who can legitimately initiate a druid nowadays? Where is the Ijaza? Where is the Isnad? Where is the Silsila? It's maktur, it's dead. To revive it is just to have a kind of ambulant museum. But at least they do feel some sort of real unease about modernity and its lifestyle's disconnection from nature and our worship of matter and money. In some sense, they do hanker after a time when humanity intuitively recognized the sanctity of nature. So for that, certainly, let's respect them. Still, turning to the way of Seyyid al-Mursaleen, the master of the messengers, we find that, yes, life is still shaped primordially. Who in modern cities still knows when the sun rises and sets? We just prayed Maghrib. No one else in Selwyn College probably has the least idea when the sun sets, but we are shaped by it. It's only the adherents of the Din al-Fitra. Especially in Ramadan, for instance, look out of your window over the point blocks of Lambeth before dawn, you'll see lights in a lot of windows. Those people at least remember what their souls are for. They're doing something very ancient. They are normal. What happens to us exactly when we are disconnected from the fundamental rhythms of life on the planet? Scientists are only starting to understand how plugged in we are to the movements of the sun and the moon. We know that the lunar phases, for instance, affect sleep. So a study at the University of Basel in Switzerland has shown clearly that we do genuinely sleep less well when the moon is full, even if we're living underground and can't see the moon. And this puzzles the scientists, and there's various theories. Could it be the gravitational effect of the moon, rather as it affects the tides? I'm not sure. Is there some human circa-lunar clock within us that still operates even if you can't see the light of the moon? We don't actually know. But if our distant ancestors lived in close recognition of the light of the moon and its phases, it is reasonable that something deep within us continues to respond to that. Other cyclical aspects of the human metabolism, which may once and sometimes still are connected to lunar phases, such as ovulation or times of cyclical low testosterone production, also known to be associated with changes in our capacity for spatial reasoning. So somehow this idea of the lunar month is a basic feature of how the mind works, but in a subtle way. So the Salat and the other rituals, which Islam connects to the sun and the moon, seem to relate to very deep and subtle and actually rather poorly understood aspects of human physiology. And ritual itself, of course, being a natural ancient human activity, is good for us in multiple more palpable ways. Study after study, as we've seen, indicate that rituals and prayer do thicken the cortex of the brain. And one consequence of this is to reduce the likelihood of clinical depression. So Professor Lisa Miller of Columbia University's Center of Clinical Psychology, who's done a lot of research on this, speaks of, quote, an extremely large protective benefit of spirituality or religion. In the case of rituals of the Muslim type, which are done from memory and the absence of books, the brain also gains from the benefits of memorization. Interestingly, London taxi drivers who've had to memorize all the names of the streets in London before they're allowed to be taxi drivers, it's called the knowledge, when they have themselves scanned, you can see there's this enlarged hippocampus in the brain. The memory does that. And it's the same for Hafiz. A Hafiz has memorized the Holy Quran, his brain does look different. The hippocampus is larger, and there's some other features as well. And science has again shown that this does benefit our well-being. A larger and healthier hippocampus reduces more endorphins, which contributes to our general levels of happiness. And the prayer also, as a congregational act, reduces our sense of loneliness and physical separation from others. And you might think that that's kind of trivial medically. But there was a recent British government report that dubbed London the loneliness capital of Europe. 1.1 million British adults suffer from extreme loneliness. And it said that the medical consequences of that are equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's not good for us to be alone. Yadullahi ma'al jama'a, God's hand is over the congregation. The Holy Prophet tells us we are to be with others. Ours is a religion of fellowship, of brotherhood, of togetherness. It's not really a religion of solitaries. Now, the Muslim style of prayer, unlike the prayer that exists in certain other religions that are a bit more buttoned up, includes a lot of close physical contact. It's recommended to be physically touching the worshippers on either side. Shaking their hands afterwards is also a widespread Islamic practice. And again, studies seem to agree that physically touching other human beings releases oxytocin, raising the spirits, contributing to general well-being. Modern lives tend to atomize us, to separate us out, particularly when we engage with others through technology. Most of our friends may not even be in the same country. But it's normal for human beings to touch each other, to embrace, and to experience each other's proximity. And clearly, the obligations of the sunnah can really help us to reconnect with this. And this is particularly important for solitaries, for older people, to have that practice of five times a day going to the mosque and being physically with other people helps enormously to dispel this problem of loneliness and to release that oxytocin. So staying in company with others and maintaining high endorphin, oxytocin levels also protects us from addictions of various kinds. Some of these are particularly damaging, the most recent being the current epidemic of pornography addiction. Recent research right here at the University of Cambridge emphasized how pornography use causes permanent changes in the brain, particularly when the brain is in a still formative state for teenagers and young people. Dopamine, the pleasure chemical, is constantly being triggered in an abusive way, which leads pornography addicts to more and more extreme and violent images. The next picture has to be still more extreme in order to get the same high. Scans show that the brain of those who regularly use pornography resembles the brain of drug addicts. So teenagers now, being addicted to this stuff, routinely impose the preferences of their newly modified brains on their girlfriends and find the girlfriends not up to scratch. And the result, yet another reason for the volatility of relationships amongst young people, and also stress for girls and young women as they modify their behavior and physical appearance, sometimes even surgically, in order to comply with their partner's internet-induced preferences. And this is a real source of anxiety and even suicide amongst young girls, that they're trying to live up to the expectations of a partner or a boyfriend's brain. The brain has been changed thanks to repeated pornography use. Another modern addiction, which happens with increasing frequency in our Muslim communities and is also related to low self-esteem and loneliness, is what some are calling fundamentalism addiction. And that might require some thought. There's a very interesting book by a Catholic priest called Leo Booth called When God Becomes a Drug. And it gives some sobering examples of how this works. In his Christian world, but I think also in the world of a lot of young Muslim extremists and fundamentalists, those who go in and out of extreme forms of religion are often coming and going from drug addiction problems. Again, fundamentalism becomes a way of dealing with the dark external world, which stimulates a happy rush of dopamine production in the brain. So here's his list of telltale symptoms of fundamentalism addiction. Listen to this. This is in his Catholic world, but it does fit with the mindset of some of our extremists. One, the use of guilt to punish oneself or others. Number two, manipulative behavior. Number three, finding pleasure in identifying the faults of others. Number four, using religion to avoid social and emotional issues in the family, typically. Number five, a general tendency to be antisocial and insensitive to the experiences of others. Well, it does sound depressingly familiar. Again, a correct and balanced Muslim lifestyle, far from drugs and lonely vices, is likely to be a very strong protection against this pathological state. Protection from extremism, fundamentalism, is not just a matter of teaching people the correct aqidah, it's also a matter of people's psychological state and their self-esteem. So as the Holy Prophet tells us, the famous hadith in Sahih Muslim, هَلَكَ الْمُتَنَطِعُونَ. May the extremists, the zealots, perish. This is not some kind of Western thing. This is our own tradition also. Strongly dislikes sort of extreme, obsessive, fanatical, dark types of religion. The Holy Prophet more or less curses them. So positive health outcomes of the kind that we have been describing are all consequences, amongst other things, of the practice of regular, very regular, preferably congregational ritual. And this is, again, to turn back to the scientific literature, pretty firmly accepted now. So here, for instance, is the verdict of Duke University's Dr. Harold Koenig. Studies have shown that prayer can prevent people from getting sick. And when they do get sick, prayer can help them get better faster. And John Mabry in Cambridge Muslim College is doing work specifically on this. He goes on, quote, "The benefits of devout religious practice, particularly involvement in a faith community and religious commitment, are that people cope better. In general, they cope with stress better. They experience greater well-being because they have more hope. They're more optimistic. They experience less depression, less anxiety, and they commit suicide less often. They have stronger immune systems, lower blood pressure, and probably better cardiovascular functioning." Moreover, of course, in the Muslim context, where prayer is really a physical thing, it's evident that the physicality of the prayer keeps joints supple, and the sajda helps strengthen the brain's capacity for memory and for hard work. A study at the University of Malaysia drew attention to a number of physiological benefits of the salat, of the namaz, for the back and posture, and suggests that the prayer is an effective way of postponing the onset of osteoarthritis and other joint disorders, as well as reducing the harm done by the modern habit of not sitting on the floor, sitting on the floor being the normal way of sitting for Homo sapiens, for millennia. And those who already suffer from arthritis, the study suggests, may find the gentle but significant movements of the prayer more beneficial in maintaining the health of the joints than any available pharmaceutical intervention. The prayer, then, is a sign and facilitator of our awareness of belonging to nature. We could see it in those terms. It links body and soul in a serene, but psychologically and symbolically powerful enactment. No doubt it's linked in subtle ways to other aspects of our circadian rhythms. Sleep is perhaps the most evident of these. We know that the human daily biorhythm is adapted to the light-dark cycle, with the release of melatonin at the end of the day preparing the body to sleep. Artificial light and electrical gadgets generally can subvert this, resulting in typically modern disrupted patterns which can cause anxiety and depression, and possibly other symptoms as well. So the University of Surrey has a sleep research laboratory which has noted that if human beings are shifted from a 24-hour day to a 28-hour day rhythm without a natural light-dark cycle, and you then take blood samples, 97% of the rhythmic genes in the body are observably out of sync and hence dysfunctional. Jet lag and medical issues caused by shift work, for instance, are pretty widely understood as consequences of these extreme modern habits, which profoundly interfere with the genetic basis of our metabolism. Something like jet lag is an extreme example, but getting up a long time after dawn and going to bed a long time after sundown is also kind of, it's not what the body needs. It has to be said that scientists don't actually seem to understand the sleep mechanism terribly well, but it does seem clear that a lifestyle which, as in Muslim case, recommends sleep right after the night prayer and getting up early for the dawn is a healthful and potentially extremely important support to our mental as well as our physical well-being. But humans are evidently biphasic creatures. That is to say, we are programmed to function not with one, but with two episodes of sleep in every 24-hour cycle. We do need our 40 winks in the early afternoon. There's a natural dip at that time. And this is, as we would expect, confirmed in the Sunnah. There's lots of hadiths about the merits of the early afternoon or midday nap, the Qaylula. There's a famous one in Sahih al-Bukhari that indicates that the Sahaba would always have a nap after the Jumu'ah prayer. There's a lot of it. And we've even noticed this, I would say, amongst our madrasa students at CMC, because the Darul Uloom institutions in England often maintain the very healthy practice of teaching after Fajr and then letting the students have a power nap in the early afternoon, usually between Zuhr and Asr. And if you go to the CMC library at that particular time, you may well see some of our students demonstrating this particular sunnah in action. But there's other aspects. There's so much to this in this rich story of Islam's rich intervention in our physical lives. A lot could be written, for instance, about Tib Nabawi, prophetic medicine. And we could also spend time on the sunnah wisdoms in our diet. Let me just deal with one of these, because this did come up with somebody who just emailed me last week about issues of a fiancé who is a vegetarian, and this is about the consumption of meat. And so very often Muslims, when they engage with people in the New Age community, who in many ways are also not happy about modernity, trying to be spiritual, trying to reconnect with nature, there's a lot of potential Islamic themes there. They're usually not happy, an Eid al-Fitr, Eid al-Adha, when the local sheep get the chop and the local vegetarians who've been kind of talking to us about conservation get a little bit unhappy. Glastonbury, the Muslim community, for instance, this is one of the things that divides them from many in the local communities, Glastonbury being essentially the capital of New Age religion in Britain. So there's a big controversy here about the way in which specifically our spirituality should take us back to nature. Now, obviously, protein is good for us. The medical case is not difficult to make. In fact, our species is naturally omnivorous, and the way in which our teeth and our digestion are designed indicates that meat is part of our mixed ancient diet and also shapes ancient rituals, patterns of life. So there's something about the Abrahamic principle, which is actually strongly represented by the idea of the Eid al-Adha. And our friends, the Glastonbury veggies, are alarmed by this, and there's a lot of discussions between us and them. And it's been one, I think, significant reason why people from that world, who get a little bit tired of the endless festivals under the moon and the pagan thing, Islam looks really interesting, and it is related to the natural world in this beautiful way. It doesn't have Christian ideas of shame, guilt, original sin. Really appealing, but the vegetarian thing is often what keeps them out. They're actually mistaken in their understanding of how to be kind to animals. We all know that there's a gigantic global environmental crisis, which they're worried about, which we're worried about, and in some measure this is provoked by excessive and abusive agricultural and also, of course, fishing practices. Consumerism and human greediness generally, plus an ever-growing global population, results in a decline in biodiversity, which for us, of course, is a shocking diminution of the number of divine signs in the world. We have theological reasons for liking biodiversity. The vegetarians, who point accusingly at the sunnah in this respect, all of that animal husbandry, often claim that it's meat consumption specifically that is killing the planet, and sometimes they're not quite sure how to reply to that. But in fact, if you think about it, it's not difficult to explain our position. It is true, as the vegetarians will tell us, that to produce 1 pound of protein, you need at least 10 pounds of plant matter in order to support the grazing animal. It looks like an inefficient way of producing the food in a world of scarcity. But the mass conversion of the world's grazing lands to arable cultivation even where that would be possible, in sort of desert areas, that's not going to be possible, but even where it is possible, would actually be a catastrophe for animals and for biodiversity. Grazing is much less damaging to native ecosystems than is arable farming. Overgrazing, it's true, can be calamitous, can destroy and desiccate a landscape. But a sensible livestock manager is going to ensure that his land is always going to be sustainable. Once you convert that land to arable use, however, and there's a kind of holocaust, the end of plant diversity, the end of the small mammals, which usually can coexist with cows and sheep, rabbits and badgers and so forth, mice, but generally they can't coexist with machine-harvested wheat or legume crops. So that's why George Monbiot, who was a vegan for years and years, recently announced that he was no longer a vegan but was going to become an omnivore. He's now eating meat again. And that's because he's read several recent studies which point to the disastrous consequences of typical arable farming when compared to livestock husbandry. There's a very influential essay in that world by somebody called Simon Fairley, and this seems to have been what clinched it for Monbiot, which shows that arable cultivation actually results in far more animal deaths than livestock production through the destruction of habitats, the death of small mammals in harvesting machines, and the poisoning of millions and millions of mice and rats in grain storage facilities. So there is food, and it turns out that here we do have a moral animal-loving case. There's also drink, and drink is one of the easiest and most acute cases. You hardly need to point to the countless lives and also relationships saved by Islam's straightforward policy of temperance and prohibition. I've already mentioned that religions that tolerate alcohol consumption tend to have relatively high rates of HIV transmission, but alcohol has so many other health consequences, and the significant ones are all really negative. The scientific evidence here has been piling up for decades, much to the annoyance of politicians who reap billions for the exchequer every year by taxing booze, a very cynical way of raising money for the state. It gets spent on the NHS, and the NHS is dealing with the alcohol epidemic. Well, we've all heard of alcoholic liver disease, and that actually causes over 4,000 deaths a year just in the UK. But that is just the beginning. 9% of men and 4% of women are classified by the NHS as actually alcohol dependent. 50% of physical assaults in the UK are alcohol related. 58% of rapes, 30% of suicides, 22% of accidental deaths, 21% of A&E admissions. The NHS is also reporting that child abuse and also elder abuse shows a very strong correlation with alcohol consumption. So one recent study at Oxford University confirms that even one glass of wine a day significantly increases a woman's risk of breast, liver, and rectal cancer. Just one glass of wine a day gives you a greater risk of those calamities. And they decided that in the UK, perhaps 7,000 women a year are affected, which is quite a massacre. But a rather depressing look at the NHS statistics shows that a huge raft of other preventable diseases are triggered or made much worse by alcohol. So here's a quote from the list on a recent NHS report on the subject. Consequences of alcohol: brain damage, stroke, fatty liver, liver failure, hepatocellular carcinoma, gastritis, peptic ulcers, diarrhea and malabsorption, acute and chronic pancreatic problems, heart arrhythmia, hypertension, pseudo-Cushing syndrome, don't know what that is, hyperglycemia, hypergonadism, loss of libido, impotence, increased risk of accidents, fetal alcohol syndrome, increased risk of adverse drug reaction, reduced effectiveness of therapeutic drugs, and the list goes on. And this is not just for your typical dipsomaniac. To the extent that you consume any alcohol, statistically, your risk of these afflictions increases. Overall, the NHS calculates that alcohol is the third largest cause of disease burden, not only in the UK, but across the developing world. And the burden often falls disproportionately on minorities and the poor, which we often forget. So consider the ongoing tragedy and humiliation of Native American and Australian people. 12% of deaths among Native Americans are caused directly by the white man's firewater. Among Australian Aboriginals aged between 34 and 55, death is 7 times more likely than among white Australians, and alcohol is the major cause. There's also the horrible curse of fetal alcohol syndrome. A study of one region of Western Australia showed that 120 per every 1,000 children demonstrated physical features and mental impairment associated with alcohol consumption by their mothers during pregnancy. And similar rates have been found in other non-Muslim areas in the developing world, including South Africa, where rates seem to be even higher. Incidentally, this is one of the reasons why there's this very significant increase in Aboriginal conversion to Islam in Australia. There's a report by ABC recently on that, which is on YouTube somewhere, which is really quite amazing and quite moving. Alcohol and Christianity's ambiguity about it is cited as a major reason for this this very hopeful movement. Anyway, I'm running very short of time and I need to wind up. It's a huge topic, as I think we've seen, and I've neglected a lot. And despite Davina's introduction, I haven't actually said anything about fasting, and specifically the Muslim form of it, which is a form of intermittent fasting, as she said. And you can find a lot about intermittent fasting on the internet, sort of very health-conscious websites. There's one good one called 10 Benefits of Intermittent Fasting, which is directly relevant to Muslim fasting and to Ramadan. So it's a big and complex subject. The conclusions also, I think, are numerous and rather complicated. But most fundamentally, we see that the Sunnah, the life form of the Hakim, the sage of Medina, conserves for us a natural way of being, a natural form of life whose absence is likely to hurt us. It turns out that despite our modern love of high-tech lives, that we actually need a lot of ancient things. We need faith, we need ritual, we need a body-soul synergy which shapes our lives to enable us to retain a connection with nature and with our natural and ancient selves in our what is now a very strange and unnatural habitat which we now occupy. If we pray, according to the Blessed Founders Council, see the world with a spirit of awe and wonder, avoid alcohol and other narcotics, sleep at natural times, maintain close relationships with others, we are very considerably extending our life expectancy and reducing the risk of many ailments, particularly those to do with anxiety and stress, which seem to be really proliferating, getting out of control in our, as it were, post-natural society. Perhaps we could conclude by proposing this as a new form of dawah. There's so many lifestyle programs available nowadays that promise better mental and physical health outcomes. You can pay upwards of £800 a day to clock into some health spas that will offer you various rather imprecise diets and massage therapies and aromatherapy. It's expensive. But when we're finished with those programs, we go back to the workplace and back to our lifestyle. We might feel better, but probably a bit poorer. We go back to the old routines and habits. So let's start advertising a better lifestyle option to our burdened compatriots, which we could call Sunnah therapy. It has so many advantages. It actually works. It seeks to turn us into interesting, spiritual, healthy, active, and beautiful people. And also, not uninterestingly, in these times of financial uncertainty, the entire course of treatment is absolutely free. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Abdul Hakim, for that illuminating talk. We're now going to open the floor for questions. Anybody from the audience?
Could you maybe expand even more on specific acts of the Sunnah that are also very good for the health? So, for example, like the Prophet's insistence on using miswak and sitting down to drink water, these kind of things, which are also now being suggested by dentists and doctors that are also really good for the health.
Yeah, I mentioned that I had to confine myself to some core things like praying and wudu, and often things that Muslims tend not to think so much about in terms of their health implications. There's things to do with sleep, for instance, and positions you adopt during sleep. It's against the sunnah and not good for you to sleep on your stomach. Sleeping on your back is not particularly good. The best position, generally, is to sleep on the right-hand side. Left-hand side is less good for you. Right-hand side, because it puts less pressure on the heart and some other organs. So sleep on the right is better. And there's so many other things. Sometimes Muslims push it a little bit too far, I think. And I've tried to confine myself to some fairly conservative and I think scientifically unarguable conclusions based on the latest research. If somebody at Imperial College has done something amazing on the miswak, it would be certainly very interesting to look at that. But I focused on core ibadah issues, tahara and ibadah, largely because that's what I have been reading about, but also from considerations of time. And because these are important. The prayer is a million times more important than the miswak or sitting down to drink a glass of water. The prayer is what Islam is for.
A question from Facebook. Are there any specific parts of the Tib al-Nabawi that contradict recent rigorous scientific study, and how do you view that in light of the list of positive benefits of the sunnah?
I'm not sure. I think you'd have to ask a hakim specifically on Tib al-Nabawi. That's something that I have skirted. Tib al-Nabawi tends to operate a lot with herbs, and those who are experts in the area know that it has certain gentle, non-toxic, positive health outcomes. It's approximately what we call complementary therapy these days. It's an aspect of the sunnah that very often we have neglected, I think. It is part of the sunnah. We do have this healing tradition. People go to the Holy Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, not just for their spiritual ailments, but their physical ailments as well. He was like the chief medical officer of Medina, and there was much there that we can learn from. Occasionally there are difficulties identifying the exact herbs and plants that are specified in the hadith, but the key ones are pretty much available, and you can buy them in herbalist shops, particularly if you go to the Middle East. Ones that you get here may not be the exact equivalent, and one assumes that even slight differences can have a significant difference in terms of their therapeutic value. And it's also worth bearing in mind that Tib al-Nabawi is understood to be part of a larger holistic program delivered by a sage who really knows the patient and is taking the patient's pulse and engaging in various ways with the patient's well-being. Whereas nowadays we tend to use Tib al-Nabawi on the web or looking things up in books, which is kind of an abusive way of dealing with it. Prophetic herbal medicines are part of an ijazah-based system, which is to do with the physicians getting to know the fullness of the patient and their lifestyle as well, not just listening to a list of symptoms. And, just looking at symptoms and looking for remedies is something that even Western medicine tries to avoid, because you have to know the patient. That's why you go to see the doctor. Remember, I once had a little computer program which purported to be able to tell you what was wrong with you if you entered all of your symptoms. This is 20 years ago in the kind of infancy of computers. It was on a floppy disk. And so I entered all of my aches and pains, and it told me that I was pregnant. And 20 years, I don't know which madhab means it can be 20 years, but it's still no sign of a baby. So yeah, Islam really wants the physician to know the patient really well, and the prescription has to reflect that knowledge.
So you mentioned earlier on about prayer being good for your health. Now, what about a regular recital of dhikr? Is there scientific proofs of benefits of this?
Well, any kind of repeated ritual, incantation or performance will have the benefit of something like prayer or Quranic recitation. If it's done collectively, it will be more effective, better at inducing endorphins and so forth. Anything like that is going to be healthy, and people's spirits should naturally be felt to rise as a result of the dhikr experience. It's just good for the body.
You touched on consuming meat, and a lot of Muslims that I'm aware of are turning to veganism now. and that is mostly to do with the spiritual dimension of eating meat. Could you talk about that a bit?
Well, that's just a subjective judgment. The great awliya and the great prophets have eaten meat. Sayyidina Isa used to eat meat. It's a kind of universal experience that this is part of what's natural for the human body. So there's a certain Hindu or Indic idea that meat contains blood and hence it is fleshly and pollutes our spirituality, which is to do with a very ascetical view of the soul trying to get out of the body, and they have strong traditions of self-mortification in that world. But in the monotheistic context, no, the saints eat meat, and the rabbis, the Christians, Muslims, the great ones, Abdul Qadir Jilani, Ibn Arabi, all the great awliya of Islam, as far as I know. And there's a few exceptions for specific reasons, al-halaj, I suppose, but generally eating meat is part of accepting the divine permission, which one does not reject without good reason. So maybe in some Indian context where Islam and Hinduism sometimes fuse a little bit, you can find even some Sufis who will prefer a vegetarian option. It's not the Sunnah, so it can't really be part of Sufism.
A question from Facebook about depression and anxiety. What is a way to deal with this spiritually, and especially if the person doesn't have motivation to do any acts of worship?
Well, that will depend on the individual. There can be many reasons. There can be a recent personal tragedy. There can be sometimes medical reasons for depression, anxiety. Sometimes people overdose on the headlines, which is generally not a good idea. We can't do much about the catastrophes of the world, so why be depressed by learning about it all the time? Check the news every couple of weeks, maybe. But there's no point in wasting your time learning about some famine in Africa if you're not immediately doing something about it. It just make you feel dismal. And as that builds up, the media succeeds in its attempt to make you kind of look at it with a sort of horrified fascination, of course you'll start feeling dismal after a while. So concentrate on what's good, concentrate on what's beautiful, follow the prophetic example to engage with the natural world, to do what is beautiful, to engage with beautiful people, to keep the right company, to engage in dhikr, and as your spirits rise, then inshallah your energy for ibadah. And you know, even quite secular people, when they have looked at actually the real benefits for body and spirit of the Muslim prayer, they should do it even if they don't believe in anything. You know, there's this movement of atheist religion now in England, Alain de Botton and his book Religion for Atheists. He says, we atheists, we're missing so much and we have such poor health outcomes that we need to do something. And so even in Cambridge, there's an atheist church now, and they're building them all over the place, so they do as much as they can of religion, but without actually being able to believe. So people, if they don't have much energy for ibadah, should be told about, as it were, the secular benefits of ibadah, so they inhabit that space, and then they'll start to feel better, and then inshallah they'll start to experience the spirituality and the beauty of the practice as well.
Assalamu alaikum. Regarding, you mentioned the alcohol. The alcohol is causing the more damage to the NHS than the smoking.
Yep.
But government has done to stop smoking, but still the government is not saying that alcohol is more expensive.
Yeah. Well, it's partly to do with the fact that they get big duties, import duties and VAT on alcohol sales. It's also to do with the fact that I think there's 9 bars in the House of Commons. MPs have that particular lifestyle, and they don't want to drink a bottle of beer, and it's got a health warning on it saying alcohol makes you 3 times more likely to rape somebody or whatever. They don't want to see that.
Even the dieticians, they are saying this: oh, 1 unit of alcohol, red wine, is good for the heart. I don't think so.
No, I mean that's a kind of canard. There is a certain tannic acid in red wine that does seem to have some beneficial cardiovascular effects. But that's not to do with the alcohol. It's something you get in grape juice and is readily available elsewhere. So it's not alcohol. That's just a kind of desperate excuse that they have just to have another glass. Yeah, not convincing.
I wanted to discuss the point that you kind of somewhat lightheartedly alluded to about dawah and the medical benefits of the sunnah.
Yep.
I think a lot of da'is, they kind of stray away from this because of they feel they'll fall into the trap of kind of the Marxist religion is the opium of the people, etc., etc. Although even in that quote, he mentions it's the heart of a heartless world, right? So I guess religion has a massive place, even in terms of bringing a soul and a reality to people. But I just wondered, you know, there's a focus in our workplace and in many offices of kind of well-being, and they do borrow from a lot of religious traditions.
Yep.
How do we then bridge the gap between that and then theology, i.e. that this is a divine, a divine sort of ordainment?
Yeah, the problem with all of those, say, mindfulness type or sort of secular yoga processes or office meditation sessions is that they operate on a rather sort of basic level of relaxation and exercise, but the deeper benefits of religious ritual are to do with the state of mind, to do with trust, hope, optimism, gratitude, which affect you much, much more profoundly. So the challenge for those therapies that you've suggested is how they can actually have not just the form of a spirituality, but the content as well. And that is something that really escapes them because of the kind of irrational phobia that people have of religion nowadays. Religion is a bad word, ritual is a bad word. Ritual is normal to what we are. Everybody has rituals. Students in exams, you should see the rituals students have. Teddy bear has to be there and three pencils, and we're ritual creatures. But it's become a kind of dirty word somehow. People feel trapped by it. They want to be free. This modern New Age spiritual nonsense about how spirituality is being free from restraints, which is completely crazy. The ego has to be restrained and then the spirit will be free, but they've got no conception of ego and ruh. They're just trying to be themselves. We don't really want to be ourselves. We know what the self is. Not very impressive most of the time. We want the ruh to be active. The self is just nafs with its unpleasant habits. But that wisdom is just not known in the New Age environment at all. So it becomes just a kind of self-help teaching, and self-affirmation, self-esteem. And they can't deal with egotism as a human vice because it's all about expressing yourself, discovering yourself, being yourself, which is the inversion of traditional religion, which is transcending yourself. But they still have some beneficial effect. I read about one office in New York where they got a secular office where they decided to adopt as their office mantra, toilet tissue, toilet tissue, toilet tissue. And they would say this regularly, and they did find some kind of blood pressure would go down, calmer. But that's ultimately what it can be, all it can be, unless there's some sense of real transcendence. But it's tricky if you've got a religiously mixed office, I must say. There are not too many genuinely religious practices that can be shared across religious boundaries. That's a tough one.
Another one from Facebook first. Are not such discussions complicit in the medicalization of society, in this case the Sunnah, which scholars like Foucault and Zola were critical of? By extension, rather than discussing medical benefits of Sunnah, shouldn't we discuss how the body one acquires through the Sunnah is different from the body that is envisaged by biomedicine?
Well, I did begin by talking about the idea of the prophetic perfection and the prophetic perfection being constituted by a balance of the Jalal and the Jamal that mirrors the presence of those divine qualities in the exterior creation. I've used a lot of examples from modern medical science, partly because they're based on empirical methods and they do yield certain outcomes. They're often quite uncomfortable to secular people. They're secular arguments for the sacred, if you like, and therefore very useful to us. But of course, ultimately, our conception of the body, the soul, the ruh is something that is derived from revelation. And particularly when you get to the beating heart of our humanity, consciousness itself, it's evident that the science breaks down. There is no scientific model of consciousness. They can't really define it. It's not a scientific term. They say that they're working on it, but they haven't really understood even the elementary functions of the brain. It's moving, but in terms of creating artificial intelligence, for instance, which is theoretically possible on a physicalist model of the world, there's no sign that the internet is waking up and becoming conscious. Consciousness is something mystical, mysterious, not really native to the physical world.
You spoke about some of the ways in which so worship or things that we would consider ritualistic can intervene in ways that upon our physical body that we can observe empirically and medically. Do you have any insights about the ways in which aspects of modern life or being hyper-connected technologically or certain forms of very new technology or other aspects of modern life have the opposite effect or observed opposite effect in terms of mimicking what we would call like occult or demonic sort of effects upon the human being that might be observable empirically? Do you have any insights in that respect?
It's clearly an important subject, and a lot of people are wondering about the effect on human consciousness and brain function of our increasingly wired reality. What is the, I mentioned the effects of pornography use on the permanent rewiring of the brain. That's something that's established and known now. What do we know about the implications of massive use of social media or texting? This university did informal inquiry recently about the impact of texting use amongst students on examination performance, whether regular texting keeps the brain kind of constantly firing, so there's no downtime, there's always a new message. Students who are sending 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 texts a month, for instance. We found some students are texting in their sleep. We find some students make kind of movements when they're asleep, because in their dreams they're texting. What is the consequence of that in terms of neuroplasticity and the possible flexibility of the brain and the limits of that flexibility? We don't really know. What we do know is that a lot of young people are hurting and reporting more and more psychosomatic disorders. There may well be a connection there, but our understanding of how the brain works is so limited, and our experience of these new technologies is so recent. In the long term, we really don't know what's going to happen to the species as a result of these radical new forms of being. Chances are that the further we go from what we're designed to be, the sicker we'll get. We shall see.
Assalamualaikum, Sheikh. Is there a concept of the mind of no mind in Islam, like the emptiness? Because when we have consciousness, we have God consciousness. But I was just wondering whether we ever, in our sunnah, we have the idea of getting our mind empty and then just seeing. It's a Buddhist type concept of shinna mushin.
That is, Imam al-Ghazali says that is not possible because the thoughts in the mind, the khawatir, never come to an end. It's just part of the nature of the mind that there are always concepts, sense impressions, something new happening, even when you're asleep. So the idea of the mind being completely blank, which is a fairly horrible idea, it's more or less like an atheistic conception of death, is not something that Islam aspires to. We want to be the best form of ourselves rather than to deny ourselves.